Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. As many of you know, Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist and also an author of Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison, is back to speak with us on penal system, the need for reform, and on other issues pertaining to incarceration and the treatment and the comparison between the treatment and rehabilitative programs and other things compared to our country, which is appropriate and successful in her country in the Netherlands. Next week, we will also have on with us on Tuesday a couple from the Netherlands who have recently written a book as well, a formerly incarcerated individual in the Netherlands, Dave Van Beem and Marieke Gils. We will also have on with us Wednesday of next week, Frans Dow from Amsterdam, a 27-year veteran, former veteran warden, who has been involved with the United Nations, with the Ministry of Psychiatry, and many, many other organizations. Frans has been in the U.S. prisons as well as Mariam Jacobs, and Frans is currently advocating for advocates in Texas. He is working with them around these issues. Mariam Jacobs has also been in the U.S. prisons. She has been doing volunteer work in a prison in the Netherlands, and she continues to do her work as not only a psychosocial therapist, but as an author. So let's welcome once again Mariam Jacobs, who will be on with us again next Thursday as well at 1 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. Mariam, are you on with us?
Hello, Leona. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Thank you. You've been quite a busy lady. And I thank you so much for taking the time to come on this show and to talk about some of the work that you do, some of the issues that you're concerned with, and other things. So please introduce yourself to the audience and let them know a little bit more about what you do and then proceed from there. Thank you so much.
As some people might know, my name is Mariam Jacobs. I live in the Netherlands. And as Leona told you, I have been doing voluntary work with incarcerated people in the Netherlands. I also have been in the Florida prison system a few years ago, and I have read the book that's mentioned, Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison. And in that book, I compare the concentration camps in World War II, I compare them to the current prison system in the United States, and I saw some similarities which shocked me, of course. In my book, I especially look at the invisible structure beneath the system, so beneath what you see. And I am now doing research for a next book, and that will be about human rights and human values and why we have mass incarceration at the same time as we have human rights. What does that say, that we have both? And I started a course, Philosophy of Law, which handles about human rights and how we deal with them and why we need human rights. So that's a very interesting topic that I'm researching now, and I hope to write my second book about this topic.
Thank you so much, Mariam. So can you let me ask you a few questions as to what your thoughts are right now on the comparison between the prisons in the U.S. and also in the Netherlands, and also what you see that really needs to be reformed in our American prisons in this country?
Well, what I think is a lot of reform should take place, but I think when advocates get in discussion with politicians, I think a very important part of these discussions should be about what is the goal of incarceration. We are not talking about incarceration, we are talking about mass incarceration, and that's a distinctive thing for me. In the Netherlands, we have incarceration, and in the United States, we have mass incarceration. So I would like to ask questions like, why do you have mass incarceration and what is exactly the goal? When you look at websites, political websites or websites that handle about law, then you see, of course, the obvious goals of incarceration, which means punishment, retaliation, rehabilitation and all that. But I think the most important goal of mass incarceration is that a lot of money is made by that. And that should be a very important part of the discussion, because what I think is that the politicians should be honest about that, that it, in fact, is a lot about money, and that makes it more difficult to reform the system if money is made by mass incarceration. So I think that's an important thing to do, to start this discussion and ask these questions straight away to politicians. How much money are you making out of mass incarceration? It's very confrontational, I think, for politicians, but it's needed. Otherwise, people keep talking about wonderful wonderful steps which should take place in reform without doing anything, because the money question stays out. So the money question has to be put in discussions with politicians. And that mind, that could lead to a mindset, a change of mindset from the goal of making money to the goal of taking care of incarcerated individuals in the system.
I'm glad you bring that up, because others have, including Franz Delf, also from your area and others, about the comparison and the need for change. We have, of course, you're aware of the audience. I don't know if you are, but Jan Banning from the Netherlands has been advocating for a wrongfully convicted young woman, well, older woman now, in Georgia prison. And Franz Kurz from Germany has been advocating for two incarcerated, wrongfully convicted individuals in Ohio. Marion Jacobs has been advocating for incarcerated both over there in the Netherlands and here in the U.S., in addition to her other. And I'll tell you, one of the things I love about these people coming on our show from the Netherlands is that they are very active not only in their country, but active in the U.S., trying to make positive changes. So these things are very interesting, what she's saying. And Maryam, I will say, you are not the only one that has spoken about these kind of issues. Not only has it been said by others in the Netherlands and other countries, but also in the United States. So I really appreciate the fact that not only are you and the rest of the associates in those countries helping our country, but also giving advice to our legislative members, whom I hope will take heed and listen. They are challenged by the Department of Corrections around the country, and it's up to them to have the strength and the courage to challenge the Department of Corrections around the country. And that does not happen in a lot of these cases. It's as though our legislative members are afraid to make a positive move. But I hope they will listen to all of you that are speaking out from other countries that are very familiar with the comparison between the countries.
Yeah, I think when politicians really open their eyes to this and see that, you know, this topic is not about money, in fact, but about all the suffer behind that money, from, you know, what incarcerated people are going through. If they really open their eyes to that, then you also get prison reform. So it starts with a change of the goal of incarceration. And then, and after that choice is made to, you know, to support the human beings and to see the suffer, if that mindset could be possible, then you can start prison reform.
And, you know, you mentioned, and this I have to bring up to you, mentioned the fact of these large corporations. I've actually had prisoners, the incarcerated population, I've had a lot of them tell me that the reason that a lot of legislative members don't want to help is because they themselves have invested in the prison system, you know, prisons for profit. And I don't know how true this is, but I've heard this from several people around the country at different times. And I often wonder about that as well.
Yeah, well, that's very scary because then you see that these politicians make money out of it, and then they are only there to fill their own pockets. And I think that also it has not only to do with privatized prisons, but also with corporations that are around prisons and make money out of it, like the food industry, healthcare industry, well, you name it. There are so many industries that are connected to the prison system and make a lot of money with long, you know, with long-going contracts. So there is too much, that's my personal opinion, there is too much privatization in the United States. Which makes it what you see is then is people pay tax money, but that tax money is not going to politicians who use it in the benefit for the community, but it's going to the privatized companies that stand in the middle of it. So a lot of tax money is not going flowing back to communities, but it's going to the rich, you know, the rich companies and the 1% of the 1%. Mass incarceration is a very clear example of this, because you are, I think, the only Western country that has not incarceration but mass incarceration. But a while ago, I saw a very interesting documentary and a very interesting explanation in that documentary about how money is made by leaving homeless people in the streets, so that people, you know, pay money to solve that problem, but that money is not going to the homeless people, but it's going to in-between people, I don't know how you call it in English, who get richer. And that's why you have homeless people. For part of the problem is
the elite.
So you see, what you see is a pattern, the same pattern when it comes to mass incarceration, when it comes to homelessness, when it comes to a difficult access to healthcare. You see the same pattern when it comes to a psychiatric help. You name it, all these areas that are needed in communities are very difficult to reach for a lot of people, because there are these privatized companies in between. And we know that they also lobby in the White House, because there is, you know, also your elections are a huge making money thing. There are so many millions that will go to all these campaigns. Now, the elections are coming up in November, I believe, this year. And lobbyists take advantage of that.
I'm sorry. As you heard, just prior to the show, I received a phone call from someone that is advocating right now for legislative members. I didn't have time to talk with them, of course, and I asked him to call me back. But as you mentioned, there's a lot right now that is coming up around election time. And I don't know if I mentioned this before, but I did mention it to Franz when he and the others were on the radio show the other day. The Department of Justice is making a lot of, they're going to be making a lot of changes with the criminal justice reform, prison reform. And one of those changes is to actually consider abolishing the death penalty, which to me has always been senseless anyway, because it's almost as though they're, two wrongs don't make a right. So they don't execute somebody for executing someone and call that justice. It gives mixed messages to people, including children. But also they're looking at abolishing or ending life without parole. And they're looking at a lot of these other reforms, even with the police, law enforcement on the outside, making positive changes and not continuing to have all of these lives taken unnecessarily. So a lot of these things are happening, but not quick enough.
I wonder, because it sounds really great, but I wonder, just an open question, is it for me, how are they going to do that? What's the plan?
And this is probably what they're working on now. But I will say, in listening to people that are professionals from other countries talking about their successes in preventing mass incarceration, I think maybe something that is being looked at more closely now in this country, because the crime is on the rise in America, and a lot of it has to do with the division between our political parties, for one, and also these plagues, these pandemics that we've been getting. And the pandemics that people forget about is that we have an epidemic in this country, which is a pandemic of mentally ill and also substance abuse, the addictions. So these cannot be considered prisonable. It can't be something that they can just keep throwing people in prison and not treating them. So these issues are all issues that I think are now coming into play. You, as a psychosocial therapist, know better than anyone what's needed for people that are going to prison with mental health conditions.
Yeah, it's insane that these people only get a sentence in prison. And what I learned recently about substance abuse is, I don't know how it is now, but there are a lot of people who are addicted to painkillers, and they abuse these prescriptions from doctors, and they get addicted to these painkillers. A few years ago, it was OxyContin, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I read that story, and again, you saw that a lot of money was earned, and a very smart game was played to keep people addicted, because when somebody is addicted, then they can earn a lot of money from that addicted person. And when somebody is sick, you can earn a lot of money from it. Healthy people, you cannot earn money from healthy people. You cannot earn money from people who are not incarcerated, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's all the same pattern. And I think this pattern should be mentioned, because it's the pattern that has to change. And with that, I mean that this money making out of, you know, the misery of other people, that should stop, because, you know, what you see now is it's making money out of the misery of people, and it's this benefits only the 1% of the 1%. And that pattern should be mentioned and not mentioned, and it should be become very aware also to the communities, that the communities start to protest against it, because they are the victims. And I think then a lot of change could take place if people see what they do with their tax money, for instance. It's all, in the end, it's all about money, and that's very painful, because it should be about the human being.
You know, you just said it. You know, these are the things that pharmaceutical, this is what's been talked about by our government too, to reform the pharmaceutical department, because we have, as you say, doctors are over-prescribing sometimes, or they're just prescribing when requested by the patient, and it's something that needs to be looked at as well. There needs to be oversight. Marion, please explain to the audience and explain to me why it is so difficult for the government to stop putting in independent providers into these places, in all of them, in organizations that claim to advocate for the incarcerated, in the prison system to oversee the overseers, in the streets, in law enforcement. People want to have it defunded, yet other people don't want to defund it, yet there's no oversight at all. And the media certainly is not a help, because they only report one-sided stories.
Yeah, the media is also privatized. So,
can you talk a little bit about the media? Because this is something that's very...
Well, the media is part of the same structure. The media is also privatized. I never watch the American television broadcast. I always go to on YouTube to see lectures and news like Democracy Now. That's not privatized. They have they only can broadcast because they get the donations. So I only watch, and they bring honest news because they bring it neutral. They are not advocating for this part or this party, that party. They are neutral. So, and I want to have neutral news because then I can develop my own opinion. So what you see is, and what you see with politicians is the lobbyists, they have, of course, a very big voice. They have the millions that politicians need in order to do their campaigns. So in fact, you can say that law is made not by politicians, but by the industry. And that counts for all these areas. When you look at the food industry is heavily privatized. When you see that farmers want to do, I don't know how you call it in English, but the healthy way of, you know, holding, having animals, stock or crops, they get punished by politics if they are not a part of the food industry. The food industry has all the power. That's why the food in the United States often is not healthy. You eat food which would be refused in the Netherlands. For instance, I have no numbers, but what I do know, for instance, is the food in your McDonald's would not be allowed to be sold here, because you have much more these artificial elements in it. I don't know how to call it in English.
Preservatives?
Too much sugar, too much fat, too much salt. That's forbidden here. That would not be approved here because it's too unhealthy. And that's shocking, you know. But in the United States, it's possible because it's all privatized. And we have also privatization in the Netherlands, and it scares me, but in the Netherlands, it's not yet the same as in the United States. So mass incarceration is one piece of this puzzle, which we can call privatization. And with privatization goes lobbying, and lobbyists influence politicians, and politicians need the money from the lobbyists. So they are dependent from the lobbyists. So in fact, you could say that the lobbyists are willing to pay millions for political campaigns, but they want something back, and they want the laws to be made in the benefit for corporations. Well, in the Netherlands, we have that too, but it's much weaker than in the United States. In your country, it's really shocking. And I wish that people would be much more aware of this. I think that a lot of people in the streets, in the communities do know this, but are they really aware of the fact that they are not as free as they think they are? They are led by and influenced by this corporal power, and it's such a huge power. I mean, it goes all the way up to the White House.
And you know what's so ironic, what you just mentioned too about McDonald's and the food that they serve in these places, I didn't realize until this past year that McDonald's is one of the corporations that invest in prisons.
They're one of the corporations. Yeah, and that's, I think, Leona, that's a big problem. And I think it's very, you know, I'm happy to hear the news that you just told me that, you know, that there are, that they are going to try to reform the prison system in your state. And there are some states in the United States who have decent prisons. There are differences between states. There's one state, and I believe it's North Dakota. I think I mentioned that a year ago on the radio show. They had a prison which is really based on the prison in Norway. It's in your own country. But all the states are, of course, so different.
It could be, this could be one of the reasons why the Department of Justice is looking at this, because what they said was that they themselves are now saying that 2.2 or 2.3 million incarcerated in prisons in the United States is just not, it's not something that we should tolerate. So they're looking at the mass incarceration now as well. It could be from, as you mentioned earlier previously about North Dakota following suit with your country and other countries, you know, like Norway, the role model of all prisons throughout the United, I mean, throughout the world. But they're starting to look at now the Department of Justice, and I'm really thrilled about this because it's long overdue. But I believe it's because of countries.
It never should have happened in the first place, Martha. No. Because you don't have mass. I think people should be very aware of the fact that you don't have mass incarceration because there are so many bad people in the United States. You have mass incarceration because, well, you know, there are because everybody who has problems or issues is put in prison, and then we talk about people with psychological health problems or trauma problems, or, you know, problems that normally somebody would go to a psychiatric hospital for. Then you have these addiction issue, and there are a lot of people, you know, it's not simply the drugs, it's not simply heroin or crack or whatever, it's also this over-prescribing from doctors who are, and they are tempted to do that because they also make money. The more they prescribe, the more money they make. So that makes people in the streets becoming a victim of the same structure again. And all these people, a lot of these people, they end up in prison because a lot of these psychiatric hospitals have been closed in the 70s. And at the same time, healthcare, and I think also psychological healthcare, is very difficult to reach in the United States if you do not have a very a good job and an income and all that. Lots of people, what I hear is, you know, when they lose their job, they also have a big chance to lose their house and the healthcare.
Yeah.
So, and if you know, like in the Netherlands, we are obliged to have a healthcare insurance. Everybody has to have it, whether you have a job or not a job, or you are. My kids already have their own healthcare insurance, and they are studying. That's mandate. Nobody here is without an insurance. Everybody has it. And that's partly because, you know, the money that we pay for it, because we also pay a lot for healthcare when we can, or we also pay a lot more taxes. But this tax money is flowing back to the communities. And, you know, in your country, it's going to these in between multi-billionaire companies.
You know, when I was interviewing Franz these past few times, and you've been the same way, you talk about treating people incarcerated as human beings versus in this country, they treat them like animals. You know, they don't interact. I was surprised to find out that the warden, a former warden, Franz, actually had interacted with some of the prisoners. He got to know them, and he talked about the treating of these incarcerated individuals as human beings, and you have mentioned that as well so many times. What are your thoughts on the treatment of the incarcerated and how it affects them in their rehabilitation process?
You mean in your country, if that would take place?
Yes.
Well, I think rehabilitation... rehabilitation can take place if it's embedded in the daily approach of incarcerated people. So if you want to rehabilitate somebody, then only giving one course or some, you know, doing rehabilitation one or two times a week, that's not enough. Rehabilitation, to me, that means that the staff approaches incarcerated individual as equal, because we are all human and we are all equal. Even when somebody has committed a crime, that person is still a human being like me. So this approach should take place 24 hours a day. So it should be the basic attitude from guards and other staff to approach an incarcerated individual from the view of humanity, equality. And that's, I think, a very important part of rehabilitation, because if I approach somebody based on humanity and equality, then I give the incarcerated individual the opportunity to learn to believe in himself and to develop a positive view on himself. That's rehabilitation. So that person gets stronger, so that person learns what his qualities are. He gets a positive outlook on himself. And it starts with how I approach him. If I keep approaching that other person as a kind of an animal, or less than an animal, I think, then how can that individual start to believe in himself and rehabilitate his outlook on himself, his view on himself. So rehabilitation should be a basic part of daily life in prison always. And that's not what's happening in the United States.
No. And
the recidivism
rates are so high in this country. The suicide rates in this country in prisons is high. You know, there's so much that needs to be looked at, so much that needs to be reformed. And people tend to stereotype the incarcerated population when, in fact, every situation is different. And that's something that they don't look at in this country.
Yeah, everyone has his own story and has his own luggage to carry. If somebody has committed a crime, then you can wonder how he looks at himself. Why did he commit the crime? What happened in his life before he committed the crime? I think if somebody is born without really psychiatric issues like psychopathy or whatever, you know, then no child chooses to become a criminal. So, you know, every child has his dreams or her dreams, what he or she wants to do with, you know, with his or her life, maybe the American dream. So what happens, that's what you should have to find out, what happened between this dream you had as a child and the moment you committed to crime. What happened on that path? And that leads to, you know, asking these questions and walking with the other person on his or her life path means that other person gets more insight in himself. But it all has to be based on humanity, equality, just what I mentioned, because you cannot rehabilitate somebody if you have no respect for that other person. That's impossible. Then it becomes an artificial thing. You cannot rehabilitate if without respect.
I'm glad you said that, because that's what happens in the prisons today. We have people that are overseeing the incarcerated population that have no respect for them. And I often wonder, how can they actually help these people to rehabilitate, to gain self-esteem and to gain knowledge of their own inner being and worthy? And then we have these people that are overseeing them that don't look at them as being worthy. It's so difficult.
It is difficult. I saw it when I visited the Florida prison system. When I entered the system, I already knew the prison system here in the Netherlands, so I could make a little bit of a comparison. But when I entered the prison system in Florida, I already felt the pressure by entering it. I wasn't even not yet in the visiting room. It was all in the beginning. I felt the pressure, and I felt the dehumanization. I don't know, I felt it intuitively also, you know, with interacting with the staff. And the staff were friendly, but they were denigrating to me on a very subtle way. And when I was in the visiting room, there were all these guards, and it was, yeah, I felt as if I was in a war, that you have to be alert all the time, you know. And I know for sure that in such an environment, it's impossible to rehabilitate despite all the beautiful courses or groups or what's told on these beautiful websites of prisons. In such an environment, one cannot rehabilitate because there is no safety, no personal safety. And there is no respect, there is no humanity, so no, it's impossible. I think incarceration is then only a matter of survival, and that's it. And that's what animals do. They try to survive.
You mentioned a war zone, and that's what it seems like sometimes in these prisons, because that's exactly what these incarcerated people are trying to do, is survive this war between, not only between the overseers, but against others in prison that are much more violent or extremely violent to other prisoners. One of the things is it's something that it needs to be looked at as well.
Yeah, because, you know, there are also very violent prisoners who are very dangerous. But for them, the same questions are important, because the person who is very violent, maybe he has a psychiatric problem, maybe he should be in a forensic psychiatric hospital. Then I wonder, when somebody is very, very violent and very dangerous, yet then you have to take measures for security. But at the same time, you have to wonder what made that person so violent, because if somebody is very violent, often there is a lot of fear and insecurity behind that, because if you are not insecure, if you have enough self-esteem, then you don't become violent, because there is no need to become violent. One becomes violent out of fear, so fear and violence are often connected, but we only see the violence, and we have to seek for the fear that's behind it and work with that individual on that fear, get insight in that fear, and that's what's not happening. We only look at the violence, at what we see on the surface, but we don't go below the surface, and below the surface are where the problems are. And what we see on the surface, that's what the consequences are from these invisible problems, which lie laid deeper.
You know what bothered me is I belong to quite a few groups on social media, and there was a mother of one incarcerated individual who had spoken about, in talking about the mental illnesses of these people incarcerated, she had mentioned that her son was put in a cell with this individual, and it was only supposed to be a temporary, I think it was for a few days, but her son had told her how when he went into the cell, there was a prisoner in there that got up on the second, the bunk, on the top bunk, and was shivering and shaking and crouched up in a corner. And she said that was an example of mental illnesses. But the first thing that came to my mind was violation. And this young man, from what she was talking about, this young man was petrified because something obviously happened to him while incarcerated, but that would also cause him to have a mental, a psychological problem. But the thing that bothered me is it was taken so nonchalantly. There was no question. You know, I would have had to been asking all kinds of questions to the person that was in the cell with him. Or even if I knew the person's name, I'd do some research myself. But this individual will go on in that kind of fear with no one helping him because no one did anything about it. And that was very sad.
It is sad. And I think it also illustrates that what is missing in the training of prison staff.
Exactly.
Guards are trained on a military way. They are only trained in security, but there is so much more than only security. Security is important, but as it is now, it's like it's only about security, suppressing prisoners, you know, because of safety. So this whole psychological thing is kept outside these trainings. There is no education for guards. guards sometimes are trained, I believe, in 6 weeks or 2 months or something, while there is a very vulnerable group in the prison. And in the prison, it's, I think the work is very complicated because you have to be tough, you have to be clear, you have to be strong, you have to take care for security, and at the same time, you have to be human. You have to be able to know where you can be softer. You have to learn about psychiatric problems, about addiction and all that. I mean, and that's absent. It's only about this military approach. But this is not the military.
That's it.
And these, a lot of times, people have said that guards, correctional officers sometimes set up these kind of situations for their form of entertainment. So as you say, not everyone is trained properly and not everyone is humane. And I think a lot of the people that work for the penal system were probably people in school that were bullied themselves, or people that were punks, you know, that were bulliers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what they hire. Unfortunately, the staff they hire, the medical, contracted medical providers, are not experienced. They're hiring the cheapest contracted providers they can get. And that's sad, too, because a lot of these people are not experienced. They're not knowledgeable of the type of people they're you know, treating. And there's been so many people who have been damaged permanently, who have been damaged permanently by these contracted providers.
Yeah, and then you see again that also that is about money. You know, to keep it in the prisons, they try to keep it as cheap as possible, because the cheaper you keep it in prison, the more money you can put in your own wallet. And I'm talking about the big guys.
Exactly.
And so and in your prison system, it's even more difficult because, you know, a part of the incarcerated people should be in forensic psychiatric hospitals, not simply in prisons. So
exactly.
It's a very complicated thing.
We have a caller, Mariam. Would you like to state your name, please? 508.
Hi, Leona. It's Donna. I'm late on the call, but I'm just calling in to listen. I'll be taking my husband to physical therapy in a little bit, but I'm going to keep you on and listen to Mariam. I always, always, always learn from her. So thank you.
Hi, Donna. Nice to hear you.
Hi, Mariam.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
We have joining us for a few minutes. As she said, she's taking her husband to therapy. But Donna Wynette is another very special person in my life because she is the founder of Family and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illnesses. So she and Mariam have a lot in common when it comes to wanting to advocate and advocating for the mentally ill behind those prison walls as well as in the community. So I welcome you on anytime, Donna, as well.
And I want to let Mariam know that, you know, when I can't join, I later go back and find your link, and I listen and I learn. It's just amazing the work you're doing. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Donna, you're scheduled to come on, is it next Friday? I think the 19th?
I believe October 19th.
October
19th.
That's what it is, October. And so Donna will be coming on for part two of Dear Laura, and that is involving, well, you can explain that, Donna, real quick.
Sure. Mariam, I had a dear friend I connected with. I connect with a lot of the wonderful family members at Bridgewater State Hospital. And this particular friend was in really deep crises. Her son, you know, was involved in loss of life. And her son came to Bridgewater State Hospital. She was pretty much in shock, you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And I have been at Bridgewater State Hospital for a while, so I kind of was a veteran, and I was able to support her. She's now very strong, but we forged this amazing relationship and bond, and we both saved our emails, and at some point we decided to take those emails and edit them and format them into a play to hopefully inspire others about the journey, the struggles, but also the joys, and, you know, having to learn to move forward and not let that, you know, that one event define our entire lives, and yet, you know, still living with the heartache of it all. So that's basically it. We've written a play.
Wonderful. That sounds beautiful. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I think learning, very educational for people who are going to see it.
Yeah, because it talks about what the system does, you know, what it does to the family. So it covers all of that. And I'm really so grateful to Leona for giving us a voice. You know, we're trying to use any means possible to get this message out. And, you know, I'm glad you and Leona are carriers of that message for humane treatment.
Well, don't thank me, please. I'll tell you, I bring anybody on to talk about any issues. And a lot of sometimes we have controversial discussions, and it's just to get the awareness out. It's to kind of like draw people in to talk about these issues, regardless of what the issues may be. And that's why it's so important. And we're all not only benefiting from it, but we're all contributing to bringing some kind of awareness and resolutions to the problems we have in this country.
That's true.
Yeah.
So I'm about to put myself on mute, but I'm going to hear you on the Bluetooth in the car. My husband and I will listen on the way to physical therapy.
Okay.
That's nice. Say hello to your husband for me.
I will. Thank you, Miriam.
You know,
have a
Miriam,
good day.
Thank you. You too.
There is a woman, and Donna knows her. I won't mention her name. She used to be in Massachusetts. She's no longer in Massachusetts, but she is still. Her son was a victim. He committed suicide, and I just emailed her to ask her if she wanted to talk briefly about it, because she wants to at some point in time. She wants to talk about it, but right now I don't know if it's for legal reasons or whatever. But Donna, it's Susan, and again, I don't believe she lives in Massachusetts anymore. But this happens in there was another one. Her name was Holly Alston, and she lives in Pennsylvania, and she lost her son to suicide quite a while back. But these are some of the things that it either happens while they're in prison or because of the lack of appropriate treatment that they receive while incarcerated, that when they come out, they do commit suicide. So what are your thoughts on this, Miriam?
Well, I'm thinking about what you say, and I wonder if we all, because I need time to process this, what does it mean when your child commits suicide, I have four children, so what would it mean when one of my children would commit suicide and I would lose him forever? I cannot imagine that, and I think it's good to think about that too. You know, that there are a lot of these examples of suicide, but that we try to understand again, what does it mean when somebody takes his or her own life? Not because that person doesn't want to live, but that person cannot cope anymore with these horrible circumstances. That's another reason to commit suicide, and that's more than sad. That's more than sad. And it reflects the horrifying mass incarceration that there is in the United States. I mean, you know, United States, I remember it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, that there was a kind of a meeting on television with big leaders from different countries. And the United States, they pointed at China and they talked about these awful concentration camps for these Muslim minority. But China said, yes, but look at yourself and look what's happening in your own prisons. And I thought, yes, United States, don't point your finger at other countries, but point at yourself and try to change that. Try to restore your own country first before you point to others.
Exactly. I just learned that they said that China and the United States were equal in mass incarcerations, but I just learned recently that the United States has surpassed. They have passed China in mass incarceration, which was, you know, something that kind of surprising, but it's true. I wanted to say real quickly, I composed a poem, and I composed it so that the people in society would understand that when you're losing a loved one, whether it be to life in prison, whether it be to death row, or whether it be to death period on the outside, that losing a loved one to death or in prison tears families apart. Please, everyone, listen. Family members are gone, and many hearts are now shattered. Some families draw closer, while others don't matter. Most families don't run. They don't fear or forget that their loved one now gone as if they had not met. I have so much family, though not of my genes, strangers who showed what their help and love means. It did not matter if death or in prison. Both families are hurting. Which family will listen? We can't forget those in society, of course, ignoring the facts of mistakes and remorse. Still, they will talk, they will judge and accuse, and if that doesn't work, they are quick to abuse. So whether a loved one, deceased or in prison, others are needed to help and to listen. Families or strangers should understand the pain, sorrow, suffering of a woman and man. We all are created by God to show love, to help one another, a command from above. No matter the circumstances, there's loss and there's pain. Families divided, society thoughts changed. Nothing is gained. This is truly a fact. Though a loved one is gone due to an act, our Creator and Father, He understands. Our pains and our losses are all in His hands. Stay strong. We are never alone as long as we keep the faith and remain in prayer for all who are lost, whether to death or in prison. And a lot of people on the outside, when something happens, a lot of people show their own criminal acts in their thoughts, in their words. So when they talk about somebody that they'd like to wring their neck, or they'd like to see them spend the rest of their life in prison, or they'd like to see them get the death row, they'd like to see them, you know, they have so much anger themselves, so much anger themselves towards somebody else.
Yeah, there is a lot of anger, and there is a lot of exclusion. It was an American man, I don't know his name, but he did a research on the whole world, and he found 5 communities around the world where people get very old, far past 100 years, 106, 110, and he went to visit these communities and wanted to try to find out how that could be, that people, you know, stay healthy and happy and get so old. And one of the things, it was, of course, a healthy food and, you know, that all these things. But one thing that really touched me was that everybody was included. Everybody in community, the old people, the young people, the black people, the white people, didn't matter. Everybody participated in the community, and everybody was needed, and everybody was included. What you see in the United States, and you also see it a little more and more in the Netherlands. I am honest about that. My country is not paradise. But what you also see in the United States, and what you also mentioned yourself, a lot of people have these mental problems. Here in the Netherlands also, we have a lot of young people having mental problems, burnout, depression, and all that. And I think it has to do with an unnatural life. There is a lot of exclusion, people who don't belong. In the United States, there's also this racism that's also a form of exclusion. And that makes people very depressed. And you see anxiety, you see these issues, and I think, you know, community should go from exclusion to inclusion. Everybody is human, and everybody has his own place in the world.
You know, that's why I have this radio show for. I try to provoke discussion, and there are so many people, both the whites and the blacks, that are extremists. But I try to provoke conversation because this is the only way that we can come together as a whole, to talk about these issues. you know, there's a lot of people of color that are so disgusted because we know there's racism in this country, severe racism. But we also have a lot of the whites that are saying, I'm tired of hearing about this racial thing. I'm tired of hearing about it. But the thing is, if they're tired of hearing about it, they can understand why these people of color are even worse or more tired of hearing about it. But we know that right when President Obama, former president, was elected, he could not have been elected all just on the votes of the people of color. There had to be a lot of whites that voted as well. And the same thing with the whites. These people that have Biden, it wasn't just the whites that voted him in. It was a population of people of color as well. So we need to have these discussions around the racism in the country, whether it be affecting the whites, blacks, red, brown, beige, whatever. We need to have these discussions to bring people to the table, to talk about it, to resolve it, to work together.
Yeah, and I think that was the message of Martin Luther King. He was not only fighting in support of the black, but in support of communion, you know, a commitment from all groups. He wanted to, you know, he always said, we are all brothers and sisters.
But you know what? In South America, in America, the southern part of America is where most of the racism took place. I remember being in a convenience store one time. I went to Florida, and the woman acted so indifferent towards me. She was really ignorant. So when I came out, I was talking to a couple of black people on the outside, and I said, they're really racist down here. You know what he told me? He said, you know, they're more racist up in your area of Massachusetts and around there, because he said, they smile in your face and they stab you in the back. I think what's happened is the people from the South have migrated to the North, and they brought their racism with them. And it's, you know, this is what's happening. But we need to talk about it. And people don't speak out about it. And these are issues that go on in the prisons as well. We have people in the prisons who are overseeing the prisons that have that same mentality, unfortunately. And this is why so many people in prison are being targeted or being oppressed, you know, afflicted, committing suicide, you know, spending the rest of their lives in prison with no hope. Look at Governor Abbott in Texas. This man is disabled. He's in a wheelchair. He'll never walk in his lifetime. And I think a lot in his country, in his state, has the worst rating of death penalties. And he's scheduled to be more death executions this week and next week. But the man is so miserable, I believe, that this is why he has such a high rate. He sees these individuals behind those walls, even though they're not maybe mentally stable, they're physically healthy. And I think it really irritates him. And I think that's why he has such a high rate of, and this is my own personal view.
Mm-hmm.
This is why there's so many executions in Texas.
Yeah, and that's what I think is an important message. It all has to do with exclusion of certain people, minority groups. Whether you talk and leading a country through divide and conquer. You know, a lot of division in the streets means that people fight each other, and that makes the politicians powerful, because when people fight each other, they are not able to protest as one, you know, as a whole. And that people should become aware of that.
I will say one thing. People hate Donald Trump. And I don't like the man, but I can't hate him because it's not his fault. I look at the way he was brought up, and I see the same thing happening with his son, his youngest son. You know, the coldness, there's no love.
Yeah.
I don't think Donald Trump knows how to love. There was an incident that happened recently where three black people were killed in Florida. And they said the young man that killed him, he also killed himself. But he left a message for his father, a letter, to look on his computer. Now, this is a young man who hated blacks, and he said that. But how did he learn to hate blacks if his parents did not spend all the time showing him love? They spent all that time showing him how to hate. And this is what goes on in this country. A lot of people that hate blacks, they don't even understand why they hate these people, other than the fact they're trying to please their parents. by feeling the same hatred that their parents feel. And as a result, not only are blacks, browns, red, beige, whatever the color may be, not only are they dying off, but the very young people who were taught to hate, they're either spending their life in prison, being executed, killing themselves, just to please their parents. So
yeah, and I think, you know, if somebody lives in the light or in the darkness of hate, that's no quality of life. So that such a person does not really live. He wastes his life in the darkness of hate, and that's it. In fact, that person is dead too. So you have only losers. You have only losers.
It's sad.
That's sad. It is.
We're going to be closing pretty soon, but I just want to say one thing. When I was brought up, to not make fun of anybody that was different than us, not to make fun of anybody that was disabled, to always respect our elders. We have people now that the children don't respect their parents, they don't respect their neighbors, they don't call anybody by Ms. or Mrs., not that I want to be called that, it makes me feel old, but this is the way it should be. Parents should raise their children to respect elders, to not make fun of anybody different than them, to try to be. I went to school with this girl, Gail. I went to school with Gail. They lived right on our street, at the end of our street, Gail Wilson. We grew up together with the sheriff, years ago, Bose. But I went to school. I went over her house one day after school. We went over her house. Her mother was working. Her father was working. Do you know, and I met the mother. Do you know, years and years later, I'm talking within the last 15 years, Gail had mentioned to me, she caught me on Facebook or something, and we communicated. She said, Leona, well, they used to call me Lonnie. She said, Lonnie, do you remember that time I invited you over my house? We were in the house, and my mother came home, and I said, yes. She said, do you know after you left, my mother told her never to bring you in this house again? I never knew that this family was even racist, because Gail and I got along fine in school. Gail used to come over my house. We were very good friends. But I did not know that her mother was and her father felt that way. So sometimes racism is hidden. And unfortunately, talked about in front of their children, it's talked about. And these children grow up with that mentality that this is what they were taught, you know, and they want to be friends, but at the same time, they're afraid because they're trying to please their parents. So parents, listen to your children. Don't give your children advice if it's not good advice. And I want to, again, Miriam, we're running out of time, but if you can let the audience know more about how they can connect with you and about your book.
I am on Facebook with my own name, Miriam Jacobs, and I have this Facebook page, which is called Deeper Justice. And I'm also on Instagram with my own name, and I'm on LinkedIn with my own name. So you can find me under my name, Miriam Jacobs. My book can be ordered by Amazon, the Netherlands, and they send it to the United States.
Great. I want to thank you,
Miriam. My book is also accepted by the Dutch Library. I was very glad to hear that. Because,
Do you know, as I said, Dave and Marika coming on next Tuesday, but they have not gotten their book, translated into English.
Oh.
And so they were looking for a way to get it translated into English. So maybe if you can share that information, and I did tell them that your book has been translated into English. So if you can connect with them again, they will be on next Tuesday.
I translated it. I did that myself.
Oh, you translated.
I translated it myself. Yes. Because if you hire a translator, it seems to be so expensive. So I did it myself.
Oh, wow.
Leona?
Yes. Yes.
My daughter actually is a professional writer, and she could do that, and she wouldn't be, you know, exorbitant in her prices. She would do it for a very low, fair fee because it's for a good cause. So just something, you know, that could be an option.
Is it possible for you, Donna, or for her to be on the show next Tuesday when Dave and Marique do come on?
I will talk to her and see if that's a possibility. Yes.
Yeah, they will be coming on.
You know, she just wrote a book, and she, you know, that hasn't been published yet. She's sending it out. She wrote a novel, but she's also been published in newspapers and, you know, college, university papers, and won local prizes. She's very good.
Can she translate it from Dutch?
Oh, from Dutch. I actually have the English version that Franz gave to me, and I think she could take it from that version and then translate it, but not from Dutch to English.
Oh.
Yeah, Franz gave me an English copy to read. It definitely needs, you know, work, but the story's compelling.
Mm-hmm. But, okay.
Well, we'll have, if anyone does know anything about translating from Dutch to English, Dave Van Veen and Marieke Schoen, how do you pronounce it, Mariam? S-C-H-N-O-I-N-G?
Say it again. How do you start?
S-C-H.
Yeah.
N-O-I-N-G.
That's strange.
It's dash G-E-L-S. G-E-L-S.
I have to see it in front of me, because the way you spell it, I cannot make anything out of it.
It almost sounds like schnoi, schning, schning gels. Dave Van Veen and Marieke. Marieke said everyone can call her by Mary. It's easier. But Dave Van Veen and Marieke Schneingels, authors and co-authors of the book. And they will be on Tuesday the 12th at 2 p.m. We will have back with us Andy Williams Jr., who is running for the presidential campaign, at 5:30 on Tuesday, that the same day as Dave and Van, but later in the evening. We'll have Franz Dahl back with us on the 13th, which will be on the Wednesday. And we will have Mariam Jacobs back on with us on Thursday, the 14th, at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So everybody, and Mariam, you said you translated your own, so maybe you could speak with them and see if something could be worked out in that area. I don't know.
I don't know, because it is a lot of work, and I am now in the research for my second book.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah, and I started my course, you know, philosophy of law at the university, and I'm working.
That's why I say you're a very busy person. So, audience, if any of you know of anyone that speaks Dutch and is able to and interpret it or translate into English, please let us know. You can contact me on Facebook, Leona Brando, or you can just call in and let us know. Donna Wynette of Family, Friends, and Individuals with Mentally Ill, and Alaya Foster will be returning on October 19th to do Chapter 2 of Dear Laura. So I want to thank everyone for listening in. I want to thank you again, Mariam, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come on and speak about all of these issues that are so urgently needed for prison reform. And I just want to thank you. I want to thank all of you from the Netherlands for doing this, because your countries have been very successful in lowering or keeping the recidivism rates down to practically nothing, compared to mass incarceration in the United States. So your input, your feedback, your discussions have been very instrumental in making positive changes in the penal system in the United States of America. And Donna, I thank you so much for coming on during these shows to contribute to what's already been said, and also to bring feedback and insight into what you're doing as well. So thank you both for coming on. Thank you, audience, for listening in. And again, tomorrow we will be interviewing, tomorrow is Thursday. Tomorrow we are going to be interviewing Catherine Johns of the founder of United for Black and Brown United for Action. And on with her will be Kimberly Biggs, who started From Prison to Purpose, who started her organization, formerly incarcerated, and also Mika McKay, who was a former correctional officer in the city of Georgia some time back. So please join us tomorrow as they come on. And that will be, let me see the time they're coming on, will be at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So thank you all for listening in, and we will look forward to hearing from you during these shows. Thank you so much again, Mariam, and thank you so much, Donna, both of you, for all that you have been doing for the incarcerated population.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you so much. We are now going to end this episode. Everyone, thank you once again.